The Anglo-Saxon World, Lecture 3, The Migration and the Germanic Past.
What? Wegar dena in yirdagum, feod kininga thrimja frunan, hutha athlingas elen fremadan. Off shield shafing shiadana threatum, monigum maiathum, mero settler oftea, exoda erlas, sitan erest where, fiasschaft funden, hethas frofra yebaird, weoks under woknum, werth mundum tha, othatim ai wilch sitenra, overron rada, huran scholde, gomman guldan. That was God, kuning. Let me translate that for you. Lo! We have heard of the valor of the spear Danes in the elder days, of the kings of the people, how those noble ones accomplished great deeds. Often shield-shafing scourged his enemies of many nations, overturned their mead benches, terrified the earls. After he had first become found in a powerless state, he overcame that, grew under the heavens, and increased in worth until every one of his neighbors across the whale road had to submit to him and give him gold. That was a good king. That's Beowulf, and it's literature rather than history, and it's not even about England, but it's still going to guide us a little bit in what we're going to be talking about in this lecture, which is the migration period. So in our first lecture, we did an overview of Anglo-Saxon, and I gave you a mnemonic, MacGyver, M-C-G-V-R, to remember the different periods of the Anglo-Saxon age. The M starts in 500. Each of these are nice round number centuries, so M is 500 to 600, M for migration. That's what we're on right now. We're going to talk about what happens between 500 and 600 in this period when peoples are migrating around the North Sea. Now, I started with Beowulf because even though it's a poem, and even though it's literature, and even though we're going to be devoting a lot of a later lecture to Beowulf, we can tease out from Beowulf little bits of historical information. And this is the case even though we don't know when Beowulf was written, we don't know why it was written, we don't know why it was written in Anglo-Saxon but never mentions England and never mentions any peoples that live in Anglo-Saxon England. And it has three scary monsters that only loonies actually believe existed. But nevertheless, we can use Beowulf because it's the only way that we have names and heroic stories, and we can correlate this with the few records we have in other places and try to figure out what's going on. So, to understand the migration period and where at least part of Beowulf is coming, you have to picture Europe as having sort of two major seas that have people circling them. And the one we're all familiar with is, of course, the Mediterranean Sea. And the classical period is really all about what goes on around the Mediterranean Sea. Rome and Greece and Egypt and North Africa and southern France and Spain and people sailing around and doing things around the Mediterranean Sea. That's the classical period. Now we're going to shift from the Mediterranean Sea to the North Sea. And the people that are going around the North Sea, from Scandinavia, Germany, Denmark, England, over to Ireland and the islands, maybe as far as Iceland, though that's much later, and picture it the same way. The heart of the classical world is the Mediterranean Sea. The heart of the heroic migration northern world is the North Sea. And what we're going to try to do in this lecture is extract information about what really happened from stories and tales and things with monsters and dragons. And you'll be surprised to see how much we can figure out from this kind of correlation. And this is, as I said, the heroic age. And people are a little troubled using that term because, are you really saying all the people were heroes then and they're not heroes now? No. What we're saying is that this is the background against which all the heroic stories are set. If you're going to tell a heroic story, you're going to put it in this time period. The same way, if you're going to tell a story about King Arthur, you put it in a certain time period. And if you're going to tell a story that has a particular background about Rome, you're going to put it in a particular time period. So that's why it's the heroic age. The heroic stories of much later peoples are set during this time. Now, the other thing about the heroic age is that despite our very scanty information, it has been studied in incredible depth and even invented by European scholars for the past couple hundred years. Why were they doing that? Why did they care? Well, you'd think, well, they were so into Rome and Greece. What's this heroic age stuff? But what happens in Denmark, in Germany in particular, in Sweden and Norway and Iceland and England itself, is that people are really interested in their own pasts once you get to the 18th and particularly the 19th century. They want to know where they came from. They want to know what language they're speaking. They're not totally as worked up over connecting themselves to Rome and Latin anymore. And they want to justify their independence. They want to justify national boundaries. And so you get a lot of money for scholarship. And just the way it is today, when money goes in one direction, scholarship follows. In this case, there's money for people who wanted to find out their ancestral roots. There's money for these various different German principalities. Each one wants to argue that it's the real heart of Germany. And so you get this set of research that goes into literature and tries to justify current things. Now, you're already thinking, I think, about that piece of garbage, Adolf Hitler, and what he did with racism and political totalitarianism and pan-Germanicism. But actually, this earlier research was diametrically opposed to all of the later Hitler stuff. It was democratic rather than totalitarian. You have to remember that what's going on in 19th century Germany is there's all these little states, and each one has a prince or a margrave or some other kind of leader. And the scholars were actually arguing, hey, we're all just Germans. We should be one country of Germans. We should be a democratic country of Germans. And they were totally opposed, and it shows how scholarly research can get picked up and changed. Okay, that was set up to what we're going to try to figure out. And we're going to start with Beowulf, because that's the oldest one. The Germans, the Danes, the Swedes, the Icelanders, they were all incredibly jealous of the English because the English had something that was really old. Now, nowadays people say, well, Beowulf, the manuscript comes from the 10th century, so it's not that old. But nobody believed that. They all were sure it was a copy, and they were all sure it was really old, 6th or 7th century. And so they went to Beowulf, which is what we're going to do also. Let's start with one name. In about line 4 of that passage I read, we hear, Oft shield shafing, shiadana triatum, monigo maiothum, medo setla oftak, egsoda erlas. Often shield shafing scourged his enemies of many nations, overturned their mead benches, terrified the earls. Now, I first say that overturning mead benches didn't mean he just liked to rearrange furniture. That meant that he subjugated them. He took over their ceremonial seats. But we want to look at Scyld because he's at the very beginning of Beowulf, and he's really important because of his name. Now, he may be mythological because Scyld Shafing could be translated as Shield, son of Sheaf, a sheaf being a thing of wheat. So the warrior, descendant of agriculture. I'm not so sure. But whether it means that or not at some deep, deep level and some mythological level, there was a dynasty of people called the Scyldings, who called themselves the Scyldings, and in all kinds of various sources that cannot possibly have ever seen the poem Beowulf, trace their ancestry to someone named Scyld. So again, whether there's a Scyld who really existed, there's a whole bunch of people in an early period who think they're descended from him. And they're always associated with Denmark. That's one way we tease out the history. There were some people in Denmark who called themselves the Scyldings, and they were very powerful. Let's look at another way, and this is how we can connect Beowulf up with history, in a sense. And this is probably the most famous discovery ever made about Beowulf. Now, again, because I'm going to talk about Beowulf later on, we're going to skip things like actual plot and theme, and just focus on names and stuff in Beowulf. But we'll get to those other things, so don't worry. Back in the 19th century, the great scholar N.F.S. Grundtvig noticed that there was a name in Beowulf, Hygelac. This is Beowulf's uncle. And Hygelac in Anglo-Saxon is the same as Clocilaicus in a Latin manuscript. You're going to have to take my word and Mr. Grundtvig's word that Hygelac and Clocilaicus are the same, but they are, if you do a few sound changes, it's the same name. It's sort of the equivalent of John and Juan and Yvonne, or Michael, Michel, and Miguel. It's the same name. Now, Gregory of Tours, a historian, so an actual historian not making up literature, says that somebody named Clocilaicus, Hygelac, was killed in a raid in the year 516, and that he invaded Frisia. According to Gregory, and this is the part that gets a little flaky, after Hygelac was killed, his bones were so huge that they left them on an island in the river, and people came to see them as some kind of fairground attraction. But skipping that part, we have Cloculiacus raid into Frisia, 516. Well, Grundtvig noted that in Beowulf, we learn that Hygelac, Beowulf's uncle, led a raid into Frisia and gets killed in very, very similar circumstances. And Grundtvig said, okay, there's got to be some truth to this, because Gregory of Tours' History of Francorum and Beowulf cannot possibly have anything to do with each other, and so they are preserving memory of the same event, and that is this raid. And so either there is this independent memory of this raid, or the poet had a literary source for this incredibly obscure thing. But this is just a good example of how stuff in the poem, except for the monsters and the dragon and the staying underwater for hours and stuff like that, but the background of the poem seems to fit with what's going on in the north. Let's take another example from Beowulf, and then I can show you how these things all tie together. As we study the migration period, we see these connections. As we physically dig things up, some of this stuff gets substantiated. So, in Beowulf, there's this incredibly complicated episode called the Finnsburg episode, because it happens at a place called Finnsburg, Finn's retreat, Finn's fortress. What happens in the poem is, after Beowulf kills a monster, there's a big beer bash, and the poet sings the song. And J.R.R. Tolkien thought he should call that song not Finnsburg, but the Freswal, the Frisian slaughter. And I think if I explain this to you in detail, you'll have an idea of what the migration period was like in Anglo-Saxon England. So, we're going to start with Finn. Finn is the king of the Frisians, and you can remember this because Finn and Frisians both begin with F. Frisians live in what's now the Netherlands, in Holland. And the Frisians are at war with the Danes, who conveniently live in Denmark. Now, to try to settle this war, the king of the Danes marries his daughter to Finn, the king of the Frisians. That daughter is named Hildebur. So, we've got a marriage to settle a feud. Hildebur, go live in Frisia, be married to Finn. Finn's happy, Danes are happy, we assume Hildebur's happy, and they have a son. It's all good. Now, the king of the Danes also has a son, as well as his daughter Hildebur, who he's married off. He has a son named Hnaf. And you can keep most of these names straight and recognize that they're Danes because they begin with H. Danes love H names. We don't really know why. It's going to show up later on. So, Hnaf says, I want to visit my sister Hildebur and her husband Finn, who's the king of the Frisians, in Finn's hall. And Hnaf sails across the sea with his men to visit. Everything is still good. Here's where things get a little confusing. Hnaf's right-hand man is named Hengest. And even though his name also begins with H, he's probably not a Dane. He's a Jute. He's a mercenary. He's serving Hnaf, but he is not actually a Dane. So, they all go to visit Hnaf and his right-hand man Hengest, and they're visiting Finn, and Hildebur's there, and for some reason, a fight breaks out, and Hildebur's son gets killed, and so does Hnaf, the leader of the Danes. But the two sides, the Danes and the Frisians, are evenly matched. They fight for 5 days, and nobody's going to win, and they recognize this. And also, the Danes can't leave, because winter has come now, and it's too icy to sail the ship out. So, they propose a truce. Now remember, the Danes have had their king killed off, so they're being led by Hengest, even though Hengest isn't a Dane, he's a Jute. But they make a truce, and they say, okay, we're going to spend the winter in Finn's hall, and nobody's going to kill anybody else. Finn says, I'm going to treat you Danes the same way as I treat my Frisians. Every piece of treasure I give to Frisians, I'm going to give an equal piece of treasure to the Danes. And they even have a funeral where they put Hnaf and the dead son together on the funeral pyre. And the truce holds until spring. But here's the problem. Remember when I talked about Cynewulf and Cynhaird and the duty to revenge your lord? Well, that's what's going on here also. So as they're maintaining this truce, the Danes, Hnaf's men, are thinking, we are at peace with the guy who's responsible for killing our lord, our leader. and they don't like it. On the other hand, they've taken an oath not to kill. Anglo-Saxons, by the way, love this. The migration people love this when you were trapped between an oath and a real duty and what are you going to do. That was like the best kind of literature for them. But setting that aside, they're under a truce, but spring comes. The Danes are going to leave, but then some warriors just can't stand it anymore. Fighting breaks out, and this time the Danes completely kill all the Frisians. Maybe they took them by surprise, maybe they stabbed them in the back. The story doesn't tell us. But they slaughter them all, including King Finn. They steal all his treasure, but they take Hildebur back to Denmark because she was a Dane. Remember, she was married off to heal the rift. That really went well. Now, here's where things get really speculative, but they also connect up our talk about the migration area with Anglo-Saxon England. And they connect up with J.R.R. Tolkien, who was the greatest Anglo-Saxonist of the 20th century, forgetting about whether he wrote The Lord of the Rings or anything else. We'll start with a question. Why is Hengist, who's not a Dane, the right-hand man for Hnaf? And why did the Danes win in the spring when they were tied in the early winter? Here's the thought. There were probably Jutish mercenaries on both sides. The Frisians had their Jutes, and the Danes had their Jutes. And why is this? Because in the migration period, the Jutes were being squeezed out. The Danes were expanding south from Denmark. The Franks were expanding north from France. So the Frisians and the Jutes were in trouble. This is why the Frisians are marrying their king to the daughter of the Danish king. They want allies. The idea is that Hengist, after this whole disaster happens, is afraid he's going to get blamed for it because he survived and then killed all the Frisians. And so he manages to convince some of the Jutish mercenaries on the Frisian side to join with him to kill off the rest of the Frisians and to go back. Now, here's where Tolkien makes a big leap, but it's one that makes a lot of sense. Hengist brings Hildebur back to Denmark, drops her off, but you know, this whole botched peace voyage, he's not welcome. So he takes his band of Jutes and perhaps some Danes, and he heads over the sea from Denmark to England, and he settles there. Now, of course, this is just a reconstruction. This is just Tolkien coming up with stuff. But here's why this is so important. Because if you remember back to that original story about where the Anglo-Saxons came from, they were led by two brothers named Hengist and Horsa. And Tolkien thought this was the same Hengist. And so that the reason these people migrated to Anglo-Saxon England was because they had been pushed out of their existing homes. And that's sort of the kind of thing that could be going on. There's some place names in Anglo-Saxon England that sort of support the idea that Hengist could have sailed up the Thames River. And that is, in Oxfordshire, you have a place called Hinksey, which was originally Hengist Ia, which is Hengist Isle. So Tolkien sort of thought maybe that's where Hengist landed with his brother Horsa. And that's where the Anglo-Saxons came from. Now, I didn't want to confuse things at the very beginning of explaining that very complicated story, but I will say that this story is pieced together from two independent sources, Beowulf and a text called the Finnsburg Fragment, which seems to be independent of Beowulf but tells about the Finnsburg incident from a different angle. And here I will throw in the only German word I will use in this lecture, which is Zusammenhang. A Zusammenhang is a hanging together. It's when a bunch of independent evidence seems to fit. And I think we have a Zusammenhang here. And that is that there is at least some connection between the migrations and movements of peoples around the North Sea and the settling of England by Germanic peoples. Originally, these were continental peoples. They had their homelands. They didn't really have a reason to leave. But as different tribes move in and take their spots, as the sea comes in and floods their fields, they move somewhere else and they move to England. And perhaps we really do have preserved here a tiny bit of fact that the Jutes who came to England were led by someone named Hengist, and maybe this is the same Hengist who's involved in this screwed up peace mission that turns into the Frisian slaughter. It might only be legendary history, but it makes a lot of sense. So far, we've sort of pieced together what's going on in the migration period, and I want to talk just very briefly about the culture that we can imagine there. This is a culture that's focused around the hall, and each tribe builds some kind of hall where they can have a ceremonial seat. This is the whole overturning the mead benches thing. And we have some evidence from archaeology for these halls. In really successful places where there's a lot of wealth, there are really big halls. But it seems like every tribe had some sort of a hall. And it had this bond between the lord and the men, often called a lord thane bond, to indicate that this is Anglo-Saxon, to use the word for retainer or thane. And it's associated with violence and conquest. We don't hear about the farmer who's just, you know, raising some sheep or growing some crops. This is all about the leaders and the warriors. And they do travel, they can sail, and they fight a lot. And different kingdoms wax and wane, and tribes make alliances and then split up. And people think of themselves as being members of a specific tribe, like Knaf's group or Finn's group, and also of kind of larger units of Danes or Angles or Saxons, probably based on language. But there's no unity there. There's no large-scale anything. It's very hard to administer a large territory without any kind of writing, without good communications. And so it's a lot of anarchy and a lot of violence and a lot of confusion. And these peoples are migrating and moving and trying to find better places to live or safer places to live as one tribe pushes another out. But you may say, Drought, this is still all Beowulf. You can't use Beowulf as your only historical text. How do you know that this stuff isn't just made up? Well, I already told you about Gregory of Tours, who gives us some independent support for Hygelac and when that would have been, around 516 or so. But let's look at another poem. This is in the Exeter book, and it's called Widsith. And in this poem, there's a traveler named Widsith, means wide traveler, who lists at incredibly tedious length all the places and the peoples that he has seen. He says, Each was mid Hunnum and mid Hrethgotham, mid Sweom and mid Geatom and mid Suthdanum, mid Wenlemich was and mid Warnum and mid Wikingum, mid Yeftham ich was and mid Winedom and mid Geflagum, mid Englum ich was and mid Swatham and mid Annenum, mid Saxum ich was and Sijum and mid Swerdwerum, mid Hronum ich was and mid Danum and mid Heathoramum, mid Thringum ich was, mid Throwendum, mid Burgendum, there ich berg yethach. And you can see that this is just a big list of people, but look at some of the people that are on this list. There's Huns, there's Geats or Yeats, they show up in Beowulf. There's Suthdanum, South Danes. There's Vikings. There's Angles, and there's Saxons, and there's Danes. So somehow at least people had lists, and the lists sort of make sense. It's a pretty accurate list of the people around the North Sea at this time period. Interestingly enough, Widsith isn't written down until the 10th century. So there aren't a lot of good historical sources again. And if they are, they're in Latin, and they're confused, and they're far away. So, again, we have this evidence that there's an oral tradition that's being passed down. You say, well, yeah, so it's an oral tradition. But it's independent of Beowulf. Again, it's in a different manuscript, and it's not connected to Beowulf, but yet it has this little passage. Hrothwulf on Hrothgar, held on Lengist, Siba at Somne, Suktur Fadren, Sithen he for Rachan, Vikinga kin, on Ingeldis, Ord for Digdan, for Heowan at Herta, Hiatho Berna Thrym. And that translated says, Hrothulf and Hrothgar, uncle and nephew, held for a long time companionship and peace together, after they had driven off the kin of the Vikings, crushed the vanguard of Ingeld, and defeated the Heathobards at Herat. This appears to refer to Beowulf yet again, and to specific characters. Hrothgar is the king of the Danes when we start the poem, and his nephew Hrothulf shows up and he's mentioned in there, and other sources that we have, including a Latin source by Saxo Grammaticus, which just means Saxo the literate one, but Saxo Grammaticus, also mentions that there's a connection between Hrothulf killing Hrothgar's son. So there's again semi-independent confirmation. And here's where it gets even more interesting. This Hrothulf, or Hrothwulf, that we've talked about, is probably the ancestor of Rolf Kraki. And Rolf Kraki is the King Arthur of Denmark. Anything exciting happens in Rolf Kraki's court. And so This is sort of what's going on around the North Sea. Now, why do we have some evidence for that? Well, Rolf Krake is supposed to always be at Lyra. It's the Camelot of the early migration period. And Hrothgar's hall, if it's anywhere, is at Lyra also. And when the archaeology has been recently done at Lyra, and Lyra is in Denmark, I should say, when this archaeology has been done, lo and behold, surprise, surprise, there's the remains of a gigantic wooden hall there that would have been this enormous hall, the greatest and most powerful place. And not only that, there's more than one. There's things built on top of it. So there seems to be a connection. And there's a connection between some of the metalwork that's found and other things in Anglo-Saxon England. So, for example, in Beowulf, again, I'm back with Beowulf, but it's a good source, people are talked about as being underneath their boars. Like, underneath the boars, what does that mean? Well, we found some fragments and some helmets in various places that have boars on top of the helmet. And yes, it shows up there in the poem Beowulf also. So this is what seems to be going on. There is cropland inundated by the sea, so people move. Some new tribe comes in that's tougher and meaner, and so another tribe moves. And you have to remember that in England, there's space. In 1080, okay, so after the Norman conquest, when they do what's effectively a census in England, it's still not even half of the Roman times population. So there is a lot of room in England also. We can also get some evidence because we can track Anglo-Saxon and Jutish burials as they start on the coast and move up the waterways into England over the course of the 6th century. So you can dig up burials and date them and say, aha, this is early, it's right on the coast. Generation later, 25 miles further inland. A generation later, 25 miles further inland. So that you see people moving along, first up the Thames Valley from East Anglia into the interior, and north from Kent. So we also get the idea, through somewhat unreliable sources like Gildas, who's a British historian, that the remaining British kingdoms were pretty weak, even in Wales, where Roman culture held on longer. So it's not just a moving into empty spaces. It might be an invasion, but it's an invasion of weak people. Now, the reason I say we can't take Gildas too seriously is he has got to be the most over-the-top historian of all time. So, for example, he talks about Constantine, the British king of Dumnonia in southwest England, and he calls him Tyrant whelp of the filthy lioness of Dumnonia. So someone who says that, don't take him too seriously, but he correlates with the archaeology, he correlates with Beowulf, he correlates with the other stories. So here's what's going on in the migration period. Remember, we're saying starts around 490 or so, but maybe a little bit earlier with the fall of Rome, or maybe a little bit later, but certainly from 500 heading towards 600. By around 570, there are enough English, that is Anglo-Saxons and Jutes, to form some kind of grouping or alliance of tribes to fight against the remaining British. The big question is how much of this was conquest and how much was filling a vacuum, and I will refer you to a really brilliant and very, very readable book by Brian Ward Perkins called The Fall of Rome and the End of Civilization. He doesn't address it directly, but he gives you the whole background in much more detail about the collapse. But in any event, they were organized enough that they could be fighting against the Britons in some kind of organized fashion, maybe because they could all speak the same language. And really, by the time you get to the end of the 6th century, the Angles, the Saxons, and the Jutes are all established. They think of themselves as one ethnic group. They have one language, though not as one people yet. Many different kingdoms, some different customs, and no unification. But that was all about to change. With the coming of Christianity, you have a new kind of centralization to Anglo-Saxon England and to people thinking of themselves in larger contexts. And so in our next lecture, we're going to go from the M of MacGyver, the migration, to the C, the conversion, and we'll see how the Anglo-Saxons embraced Christianity.
This ends Lecture 3.